Edition of KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Ernest Perry and Mike McKean. We're coming to you live tonight from the Missouri River Regional Library in Jefferson City, and we'll be with you until 7 o'clock talking about what everyone else is talking about this week, the election, the direction it's taking, and what the media's role has been in it. Mike, when we left off last week on our program, we were talking about what we were expecting from the third debate, what we were going to expect to see Wednesday night. Did it live up to your expectations?
Well, I think it lived up to my predictions as well. You'll recall that I was talking about whether Chris Wallace was going to do a good job or a poor job, the criticism he was receiving from some quarters for saying he wasn't going to fact check the candidates, and then all the suspicion people had about Fox News to begin with. But I think all of the reviews, almost every single one that's come in from the pundits, say that he did a very good job of hosting that third debate. He kept it on topic. He started with real issues like the Supreme Court issue. He didn't focus entirely on the, you know, the points of the moment around Trump's tape or the accusations of the women or Hillary Clinton's leaked emails. He got around to those topics and generated some interesting news from them. But I thought it was the best moderated debate of the three, and I think there was more substance in that debate as a result of the way he handled it.
Your take, Ernest.
Well, I agree with what Mike said, and he was asking questions, pointed questions of the candidates, and in particular, he was holding them accountable for some of the things that they've been saying on the campaign trail. And I know a lot of the conversation revolved around Donald Trump's, his the comment he made about whether or not he was going to accept the election results and that sort of thing. But I think what was missing from a lot of that coverage afterwards is that he also held Hillary Clinton accountable for some of the things that she had been saying on the campaign trail as well.
Give an example of one.
Well, one of the things that he really pointed out about Hillary Clinton was the emails. Mm-hmm. He actually asked some pointed questions about that we hadn't heard since the first election, and so she had to answer to some of those things. And I don't think that her answers were really anything that the public hadn't heard before, but she didn't really answer the question. Oftentimes she'd revert back to other things. And he would go back at her again about that. He'd come back at her again. But to me, you know, part of the problem was that in the coverage of it afterwards was that got drowned out by what Donald Trump had said about whether or not he was going to accept the election or not.
It was interesting. That became a really hard thing for the spin doctors to try to turn after the fact.
Right. And I guess the only criticism I would have about the media's handling of that third debate during that evening was the fact that it's like we can't walk and chew gum at the same time. We can only find one narrative, and the one narrative of that whole debate that drowned out everything else, as far as the journalist was concerned, was whether or not Trump would accept the outcome of the election. It was an outrageous thing to say, and it was something that deserved media attention. But also there were questions about partial birth abortion. There were questions, you know, about a lot of other, the national debt, about the Clinton Foundation, the Supreme Court. Did the journalists and the pundits talk about that in their post-debate coverage? Maybe some the next day, and maybe some of the printed press did. But why can't we talk about more than one thing at a time? And I think I'll say a little bit more later about that when we're talking about going forward in the future after the election. But if we can't get beyond this simple sort of moments narrative approach where we can only talk about one thing to the exclusion of everything else, we're not going to do our duty as journalists, I don't think.
And I do think that one of the things that did come out in this that didn't get a lot of play as well was healthcare. I mean, finally, a question was asked about Obamacare and where each candidate stood on that. And I think Donald Trump gave probably one of the best answers that he's given in any of the debates about what are some of the problems with Obamacare. And Hillary's response was, well, yes, there are problems and we're going to fix that. But it all got drowned out, along with Supreme Court answer. It got drowned out by the whole thing about whether or not he's going to accept the results of the election.
One interesting topic not to have been brought up in any of the debates, climate change, ignored almost entirely.
Yeah, I think there are a few of those sorts of topics that haven't been covered well or haven't been covered at all. And to a certain extent, given the debate format, the candidates have somewhat of a control over what they're going to talk about. But I do think that there are issues like climate change that should have come up. There are probably other questions just about entitlement reform that got very little coverage, and yet that's going to be very important to all generations of American citizens in the next few years if we don't do something about that. So, yeah, the media and the debate moderators specifically could have asked about some other topics, and I'm afraid part of it just had to do with, you know, all the oxygen gets sucked out of the room by whether it's, you know, Trump's, you know, alleged advances on women or his refusal to say he's going to accept the election or all the talk about the emails and whether the Russians were to blame. Those are important issues, but we've got to talk about more than that.
Yeah. And the one thing that I did like about Chris Wallace's basically what he did in handling that was that he sort of tried to minimize as best he could the candidates talking over each other and minimize the audience's participation when they're not supposed to be participating.
It was quite a line when he said that about what you're doing here isn't beneficial to anyone.
Exactly. And I wish that that had taken place in that first debate. And I think if it had happened then, you probably wouldn't have seen some of that happen in the third debate. And I think he handled that very well. And after that point, you didn't have the audience making, you know, comments or clapping or booing and that sort of thing. I mean, that's not what the debates are about. That's not the way it's supposed to set up, And I'm glad that he handled it the way he did.
It'll be interesting to see whether Chris Wallace's debate performance has any impact on how people perceive Fox News. He certainly felt a burden there to represent Fox News as the first debate moderator from that news organization. And clearly he was trying to set down a marker that the news division is different from the Sean Hannitys and the Bill O'Reillys, et cetera, that are on that network. I don't know if he's moved the needle at all, but he certainly did a good job of representing that wing of Fox News that sees themselves as serious journalists.
Well, when I first sat down to talk about tonight's program with Madeline Mattson, the adult reference and programming librarian here at the Missouri River Regional Library, we came up with some language for our promotional materials. And I want to read to you what we came up with. We said that the closer we get to Election Day, the hotter the rhetoric gets. We rely on our news media to cut through the clutter and to put it all into context. But where do the opinions end and the true reporting begin? Well, let me tell you, we wrote that on September 22nd. That's coming up on 5 weeks ago. Let me pose the question to each of you. Where have you seen the opinions end, and where has the true reporting been?
That's a little mushy.
I know.
Here we are, less than 2 weeks out, and I think we're still sort of grappling with where's the reporting and where's the opinion. I think that there's been more reporting, especially since the first debate, that there's been more reporting going on. Even when you talk about the tape that came out on Donald Trump,
the Access Hollywood tape.
I mean, yes, there was a lot of opinions surrounding it, but there was actually some reporting going on in terms of what other instances has Donald Trump been involved in related to this, and the reporting that went into the women who came forward, and there was a lot of fact checking involving various news organizations in going back to see whether or not their stories could be substantiated. So there was some reporting there. So I think there's a mixture here. But to me, it seems like there's better reporting now than it has been in the past 15 months.
I mean, I think the biggest problem, and we've talked about this on the show in the past few weeks, is whether or not large percentages of the public perceive the difference between opinion and reporting from journalists. I mean, is fact-checking, or is it simply, you know, trying to slam Donald Trump? A lot of people don't agree on what are the facts.
So here's another example, perhaps, and I would ask you, is this reporting or is this opinion? The New York Times, in the Sunday paper and online, published a two-page spread of every single person, organization, or entity that Donald Trump had slammed on Twitter.
Well, it's fact. All they did was copied the tweets and put them in a format that people could read and organize them. So, I mean, it is factual if you want to look at it that way. And I would even argue it's factual for journalists to say, Donald Trump lied about a certain thing, or Hillary Clinton was obscuring what happened with her emails, or what those things you wouldn't have heard, especially using the word lie. Journalists just don't go that far normally, but this campaign has been a different kind of campaign, and there have been such a high percentage of untruths, especially from one side, that you have to call it out if your job as a journalist is to reflect, you know, facts, whatever those are.
And I think a lot of the information that's come out, whether it came out through Access Hollywood or it came out through individuals saying certain things about Donald Trump and to a lesser extent Hillary Clinton, has forced journalists into doing some of the reporting in order to be able to determine whether or not there's some accuracy there, whether there's any kind of truth there.
There's some shame in that, isn't there? Like, should we be forced into having to do the reporting? Isn't that what we should be doing from the outset?
Yeah, but this is what we've been talking about in the 15 months that we've been covering this, is the fact that journalists weren't doing that, and then they found themselves in a position where they had to do it in order to either develop more credibility in this election or to just keep the naysayers at bay.
And I don't think that the shame is necessarily at the level of the individual journalist or reporter so much as the editors or the news organizations deciding how they're going to play things, whether it's, you know, the New York Times or CNN or whomever. There are reporters who have been diligently following the Clinton Foundation or the Trump Foundation or the substance of the emails that have been put out there by WikiLeaks, but it just gets drowned out by the obsession over, you know, personality and fitness for office.
The last couple of weeks, and this, I think, goes to the point that you just made.
Yeah.
The last couple of weeks, you've seen the Republican establishment actually blame the media for the rise of Donald Trump and basically said, if you all had done this kind of reporting back during our primaries, he may not have been our nominee. And that, when I read that in several articles while I was, you know, out of town the last couple of weeks and getting a chance to read a lot of news articles, I was just astonished to actually hear some of the Republican establishment figures come out. And these are people who are at conservative think tanks who are basically saying this.
I mean, I do think there's a certain level of truth to the fact that Trump got so much more coverage than any of the Republican primary opponents that he had. On the other hand, he was a master at manipulating the media and knowing what people wanted to hear and what people were willing to put on television. On the other hand, if you want to look for a direct cause, I'd say if there were superdelegates in the Republican primary process, there wouldn't be Donald Trump, the Republican nominee, right now.
Okay, so let's talk for a minute, too. I want to get into the realm of hate speech, and starting with some debates that have been going on within the ranks at Facebook and how different types of news articles or different types of content were being shared on Facebook, and some infighting there in terms of what could or should be allowed to be shared within trending topics, within different channels there, and who wanted to have that there and who said no, it should be taken down.
Well, so there was an argument within Facebook about whether or not some of Donald Trump's campaigns or comments earlier in the campaign, say about a Muslim ban, for example, mm-hmm. shouldn't be taken down as hate speech. And it went all the way up to Mark Zuckerberg, you know, the CEO of Facebook, basically saying, well, maybe you could categorize what he said according to our terms of service as hate speech, but there's no way that we could say we're going to censor one of the two main party candidates for president of the United States. Not everybody within Facebook liked that, but if you put that in the context of the controversy a little earlier in the year when Facebook allegedly had staff who were censoring conservative content that was going out, there was no way politically that Facebook could decide that they were going to not put Trump's content out there because it might violate their terms of service.
I mean, and if you go back and you read these stories, there's this sort of tinge of, at least from Zuckerberg mm-hmm. and his advisors, that they're protecting themselves against any kind of backlash that could come from conservatives or from Trump and his people to this sort of inside conflict going on about whether or not what Trump is saying is considered hate speech. So I think it's a little bit of protecting the brand of Facebook that was going on there as well.
And this really does expose a big, bright line with regard to Facebook, whether or not Are you a social medium that allows any kind of conversation to go on as long as it meets your criteria? Or are you a news publisher?
Well, when Zuckerberg says you can't delete it, it's part of coverage of the election, to me that pokes a lot of holes into his philosophy that he's not a news site, that it's entirely a social network. He's making editorial decisions right there.
And you could argue that he made the right editorial decision in this instance if he's a publisher of news, which I would argue that Facebook is. But just, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about how they took down a photograph of the little girl being napalmed in Vietnam that was a news photograph, and it was being used to talk about a news story. So it's hard to say that your terms of service, which are there to try to maintain a civil conversation and therefore continue the brand and generate the advertising you want, and then say, on the other hand, we can't censor a political.
Well, it's one of those things where you're saying, okay, those of our users who are using Facebook to share with others, they're in control of their content, but in this instance, we're going to be in control. You can't have it both ways, and I think that's what he and his advisors are struggling with right now.
So here's another theme that is pretty troublesome, and we've seen how reporters have been treated, especially in the past few weeks. I'm about to throw a lot of numbers out at you. A lot of this coming from a study that was released a couple days ago from the Anti-Defamation League that looked at hate speech very specifically on Twitter. The ADL analyzed 2.6 million tweets that were directed at 50,000 journalists in the United States. From that sample, nearly 20,000 anti-Semitic tweets were sent to at least 800 journalists during a 12-month period. The top 10 in that cohort were on the receiving end of 83% of those messages. So 10 of those 800 journalists received 83% of those anti-Semitic tweets. And The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg was on Morning Edition on Monday talking about this, and he was very specifically asked about it. He showed up in that list of the top 10 who were targeted, and he said he considers it a compliment and that he looks at the people who are making those statements to him, and they are almost entirely Trump supporters.
That's disturbing, first of all, just the nature of the attacks. What's also disturbing to me is that, journalists have tried really hard to keep themselves out of the story. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that generally they would say to you, we're wearing our big girl and big boy pants and we can take it. But some of these attacks really go beyond the pale. And it isn't just Trump supporters at rallies who are doing this. We talked about last week, the story from the Arizona Republic where they dared to endorse Hillary Clinton after never endorsing a Democratic presidential candidate ever. And the publisher herself was receiving private threats. And people were talking about Don Bowles and intimating another bomb could go off at the Arizona Republic for that kind of behavior. Journalists don't want to be a part of the story, but how can you not cover these things?
Well, I mean, right after the second debate, there were journalists who were nearly accosted at Trump rallies to the point where you had...
Where there's the common cry of CNN sucks tell the truth.
Exactly. I mean, there were news executives actually talking about if we're going to continue to cover this campaign, we may have to hire our own private security to protect our journalists out there trying to cover it from a lot of this sort of aggressive, not just talk, but people actually going up to journalists in a threatening manner. I mean, this is something that I haven't seen in all of my years of watching journalists and being a journalist and covering campaigns. I've never felt threatened covering a campaign rally, and to see journalists having to deal with that, it's astonishing.
I do think that we have to be careful. In a typical campaign, there are going to be extremists who support either of the major party candidates, and they're going to do and say things that we should not blame the candidate for, as long as the candidate is not inciting them or as long as the candidate is not refusing to denounce them. But in each of those instances, Trump has incited, one could argue, people at his rallies, especially the last couple of weeks, the things he's saying about the media. And he's refused to denounce people who claim to be Trump supporters who have been involved in some of these things.
So we know that the media, that reporters, that journalists, that we're not necessarily popular, right? We've had Pew Research studies tell us that forever. We've known that for years. But outright attacks on the media, we have to cover those. So how do we make ourselves, well, first of all, how do we fairly cover the people who are attacking us as we do our job? And how do we, I don't want to say create sympathy, how do we make our plight known too?
You know, I think we just have to play that very carefully. Yeah. And frankly, it looks like special pleading when the journalists talk about, oh, you know, they're coming after us. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to look at it from either side, there have been people attacked at Trump rallies. There have been, I mean, people from Trump supporters attacking people who were there protesting. And frankly, there appears, if you believe the video, to have been some collusion on the part of some Democratic Party operatives to incite violence at a Trump rally in Chicago. So those sorts of attacks on real citizens are probably more important for us to cover than attacks on us, unless there is some real physical violence that you can't ignore.
But I think one of the ways to deal with this issue is to look at journalism and journalists and the media that are covering this and trying to cover this in a way that gives both sides mm-hmm. their equal time, is that this is a part of a democracy. This is a part of our electoral process. And if we can keep hammering that home, that may be one way that we can build this empathy that you're talking about yeah. so that people understand this is a part of our political process and of our electoral process.
Well, there are a lot of states where voting has already begun. In Oregon, Washington, and Colorado, voters cast their ballots by mail. And in a lot of other states, there are already long lines at early voting stations. Given that voting is already underway, what types of things are you looking for, wanting to see, expecting in the actual covering of the voting and the election process, the electorate itself?
Well, one of the things that I would hope to see is if there are long lines out there and people aren't being allowed to vote, that's a story that really needs to be covered, especially since there's been a lot of coverage of various voting irregularities or various initiatives that are out there to sort of hamper voting.
Also a lot of changes to the voter laws.
A lot of changes to the voter laws, and the fact that you've had courts that have said that many of these laws are unconstitutional. But then there are other things that are put in place. So I think, to me, on Election Day, that, along with what happens in election, that story should be covered as well.
You know, I'll also be kind of curious to see whether or not there's much voter intimidation. There's a lot of concern about that. I don't know if it will happen. But I also think we maybe ought to not fan the fire of worry about what's going to happen at the polling places. I mean, I think about, for example, all of this talk of how many dead people are registered.
Yeah.
That is just not a significant issue, because the fact that you're registered to vote doesn't mean that somebody cast a vote for you. And I think that the likelihood that there's going to be any more voter fraud or, frankly, any more intimidation than there typically is in an election is probably pretty low.
I'd be interested to see whether or not any of these Russian advisors or poll watchers are going to show up. And wow. I found that to be very interesting that it lasted.
I'm shameless, so I'm going to go ahead and make a shameless plug for a project that I'm going to be working on at the School of Journalism and that KBIA is going to be involved with as well. It's called Election Land, and it is a collaboration between ProPublica, the Gannett newspapers, and public radio stations across the country. And we are going to be using social media to actively watch people in the voting process in terms of what they're reporting about long lines, what their personal voting experiences are. And then we're going to be reaching out to verify the information in those social media posts. And when we find out about problems or irregularities at certain precincts, work with reporters on the ground in each of those states to go ahead and help dispatch reporters to the local precinct so that we can perhaps impart some change during the actual election process. So the Missouri School of Journalism is one of 13 journalism schools doing that across the country. So we will be monitoring Missouri plus seven other states in the Midwest and helping to dispatch reporters on the ground.
That's a great project. Can I make another shameless plug?
Quick shameless plug.
So not during the election, but after the election.
Okay.
So we're doing a project with PolitiFact, the folks that are known for doing the pants on fire fact checking. But they're also getting ready to relaunch something they did when President Obama was first elected. And that's to track the promises that the president-elect makes and whether or not those promises are kept. If not, why not? And so we've had students working on some social videos to put out there to help illustrate the top promises. And we're going to track them based on what people believe are the most important promises to them. So I think that could be a very interesting project.
Okay. Going forward. Well, before we run out of time, let's talk for a minute or two about what happens on November 9th, because there does have to be a morning after. Is the media going to be able to break its addiction to these two candidates?
That's interesting. I almost think they're going to have to come to some sort of agreement that Donald Trump is if he's not the president, it's not the story. And if Hillary Clinton winds up losing this election, that's going to be a huge story, looking at where we are with the polls and everything else that's going on. So, but usually what happens after the election is all the focus shifts to the president-elect, and the person that loses sort of goes away. It's going to be
That's going to happen?
Well, I'm not sure that's going to happen, because Donald Trump is threatening to create his own television network, which means this could go on for a while.
Now, I don't think we're going to lose our addiction to Trump. I mean, first of all, he probably will have some sort of streaming video service. If he can, you know, crawl out from under the rock after losing. The New York Times ran some interesting taped interviews the past couple of days that show that all he really cares about is, you know, winning and the perception that he's not being embarrassed. So I don't know if he'll come out if he loses and start up that own TV channel right away. But I do think we're still not going to be rid of our addiction, because it's symptomatic of the larger problem I was talking about. It isn't just whether or not Trump will continue to suck the oxygen out of the room, but it's whether journalists can get over this habit of saying we can only cover one thing at a time, right, one big topic at a time, whether it's the presidential election or the Malaysian airliner or the cruise ship with all the bathroom problems.
That's one of your favorites.
If we can't get off of that and focus on covering a well-rounded approach to the various issues that are really important to people, then, and one of those issues, I think, we can't blame Trump supporters, or for that matter, Bernie supporters, for this focus on inequality. No, we've got to do some more coverage about why people feel like the system is cheating them.
Well, you know, that topic was something that we on this program began talking about. I think it was a couple of months before Trump announced that he was running, because we considered it to be a topic. And here we are, less than 2 weeks out of the election, talking about it again. You're absolutely right. And the question becomes, will the next president and the next Congress deal with that issue? Because if not, we could be right back here 4 years from now, maybe with another candidate, possibly on the Democratic side, using that and the populism that comes from it to garner their election.
And frankly, that rhetoric maybe has an imperfect vessel in the candidate Donald Trump right now, but somebody could come along who could take that message and blame the wrong people or the wrong institutions for a serious problem that we need to deal with.
Okay, well, we are just about out of time for today. I would like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics that we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @ViewsOnKBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan and KBIA's Nathan Lawrence. They made this entire live remote possible, setting us up, engineering our sound, and making sure the broadcast reached you. Wherever you are tonight, I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week for Views of the News.